You. The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country, playing now through October 13th at the Imago Theater in Portland. Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country is a raunchy outlaw country musical about a sexually frustrated cowgirl on a tragic comic ride from hell who will do whatever it takes to get off. Written by local award-winning and Grammy-nominated songwriter Amanda Richards and directed by Sarah Pope, this off-color comedy offers a feminist perspective into a world of dive bars, drunks, and country music. Again, that's Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country, playing now through October 13th at Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Feminist News and Public Affairs. I'm your host, Della Ray, and you are listening to your community radio station on KBOO 90.7. We have been on air for 39 years. You can find out more at kboo.fm/breadandroses. Joining us in the studio is Cinda Stevens Lonsway, author, spiritual advisor, workshop facilitator, and speaker. The book is I Know Now: A Woman's Healing, Violence to Victory, Trauma to Truth. And this book was published by her co-company, New 72 Media. This book is a finalist for two prestigious book awards, the Eric Hoffer Book Award, Montaigne Medal, and the First Horizon Award. Welcome to the studio, Cinda.
Della, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Tell us about you. What do you want us to know?
Okay, all about me. Well, first and foremost, I'm a mother of two grown boys, mm-hmm. men, young men. I'm a wife. I love my pets. And probably what brings me the most joy right now outside of family is the work I do with spirit, if you will, as my spiritual advisor with people who are in need and healing, helping heal people heal from trauma.
Okay. So you wrote this book. Let's go back to 1981. You were 19 years old. Tell us what happened.
All right. So my friend and I rented a house in Portland, in Southwest Portland, a two-bedroom, small, sweet little house. And in the middle of the night, something woke me up, and there was a stranger standing at the foot of my bed, and he attacked.
What woke you up?
I heard a noise, and I thought it was our cat, my roommate's cat, who was a little bit of a pest. Mm-hmm. And I thought that he might be chasing a mouse because he was hissing and growling. And I woke up ready to shoo him out of the room. And instead of seeing the silhouette of a cat, I saw a silhouette of a man.
What happened next?
Well, he lunged when I screamed. And it was a scream that was primal and frightening, something that came out of me that I had never heard before. And then from that point on, we spent 3 hours together as I tried and attempted to keep him from raping and killing me.
What did this person do?
Well, during that those 3 hours,
yes.
Well, it was a back and forth struggle between me trying to distract him to what he came to do, and And there's all sorts of different ways that I did that. Some are funny, some are clever, some are unbelievable. And then there would be a moment where he would lunge again and attack, and he would try to smother me. He would try to strangle me. And at one point, we're sitting on the bed completely naked, and I had to use some wit. So I had to use some wit. And at the end of that 3 hours, I was able to trick him into leaving because the cat made another noise, and I let him think that it was my roommate waking up.
I read this book, Cinda, and there's a part in this book where you describe how he smelled.
Yes.
And I could smell him.
Yes.
From your description and you saying how it literally made you gag.
Yeah.
Because the stench was so horrific.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is when I wrote this book, I knew I had these, what I call these snapshot memories about what happened to me. And for those 3 hours, there were situations and incidences that I had singed in my brain. Mm-hmm. And, and part of that was the smell. Part of that was his smell of body odor and of his, it smelled like stale alcohol and sour cigarettes, or sour alcohol, stale cigarettes, and a body odor that hadn't been washed for perhaps a while.
At what point did you realize that you were going to get through it?
I don't know. I watched him. I mean, I couldn't see him because my bedroom was completely black, dark, dark, dark. You know, it was way early in the morning. And
what time was it?
I think I remember him coming in around 3 o'clock, and then him leaving around 6.
3 a.m.
3 a.m. Mm-hmm. And it was October, a late October night when this happened. So, when did I think I was going to be okay? I don't know if I ever did, but I knew that I could tell that towards the end of that 3 hours, he was getting really tired. Mm-hmm. And so I think he wanted to leave, but he didn't know how to. And because so far nothing had been successful for him. But yet at the same time, he just wasn't going to get up and walk out the door. So either he was going to finish me off or finish with whatever he came in to do. And I just knew until the very, very end, until maybe my roommate woke up and the lights, you know, the sun came out, that I would be able to then actually look at him and tell him to get him the heck out of my house.
Let's go back because, you know, I've read the book. Our listening audience has not.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit more. I mean, there's a point in this book where you talk about at the time you had braces and were just saying how your mouth was cut up from the inside and it was bleeding and you were swallowing your own blood during the attack. Let's talk about what happened and talk about how you, give us some specifics about how you got through this.
Right. So when he first lunged at me, you know, I had my box springs. I was, you know, 19 years old. I didn't have a lot of belongings. And so my box springs and my mattress was on the floor. And when he lunged on me, his weight was on top of me with his hands around my mouth. And I had braces, brackets on the back of my molars and rubber bands that were pulling my bite into a tighter thing. I didn't have braces on the top of or the front of my teeth. And I realized that with that pressure over my mouth, not only could I not breathe, but he was also tearing up the inside of my cheeks. And I used that to my advantage because, so I discuss in the book that how the blood, when I tasted blood, I panicked because I thought maybe with the rubber bands, when I had screamed, I'd actually pulled a tooth out. But I couldn't judge because this pressure was too firmly around my mouth for me to be able to feel if I had lost a tooth. But tasting the blood triggered something in me that brought me back into the awareness of the moment. And it made me start flicking at him and tapping him. And I realized that I might be able to distract him because I need him to know that he's hurting me. I mean, that was first round one of the weird stuff.
But he has you pinned down,
yes,
hand over your mouth, and you're tapping him.
I'm tapping him. I'm tap, 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 swiping, tap, tap, because I can't talk. I can't breathe. I'm panicking. I'm tasting blood. I can't even swallow because the pressure is too intense over my face and my nose. And I just start tapping and tapping, and I didn't have any fingernails to scratch him. And he was too strong for me to pull his hand off of my mouth. But for some reason, you know, he said, "Don't yell," or something like that, and pulled his hand off. And I said, "Hey, you know, you don't need to be so rough. I'm not going to yell again, but you're hurting me."
How did you get him to take his hand off your mouth?
Tap, tap, swipe. Tap, tap, swipe with my fingertips and trying to swipe his hands off. It was a very gentle movement versus a pulling it off and you know, pulling his hand off or being violent back.
Where did you get the mindset to be gentle in a setting like that?
I don't know. Something in me knew instantly by when I screamed is when he lunged. I screamed, he lunged, and I thought, if I scream again, he's gonna hurt me more. So I need to be cautiously aware of where his mindset is based upon the energy that I was picking up from him, because of course I couldn't see him.
But you were able to think this through in a moment of dire
pure terror.
Pure terror. Where did this person come from? How did he get in your house?
So we started a conversation like, "How did you get in here?" And he said that he had climbed through the bathroom window. And I think that that wasn't how he got in, but that's how he told us he came in.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO, your community radio station, 90.7 FM. We are in the studio with Cinda Stevens-Lonsway talking about I Know Now. And so you had a conversation during this attack to realize how he got into your home.
Yeah, I asked him, "How did you get in?" I asked him, and he told me how he was planning on leaving. He asked all sorts of questions about the house, like he'd been in there before.
What did he ask?
Well, he asked if there was the pile of clothes still in the basement, for example. And we had a really skanky, damp basement with a washing machine and dryer down there. And when we moved in, there was a pile of dirty laundry. And that laundry was still there, and the landlord never came to take it away. Well, this guy knew that that pile of clothes was still there.
And that happened here in Portland.
You
were in Portland when this happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So during the time you were being attacked, how did it transition from violence, all of it's violent? And I send it, you know, this conversation couldn't be more pertinent than today, given what's happening on the main stage.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, when we started our conversation just now, you said, "I think," when you talked about the time. And so I want to make sure we do talk about this. You know, you were saying, "I think that an event happened at this time." So I want to just talk a little bit about memory in this kind of trauma, especially given what's happening on the main stage. Let's talk about that.
Well, so like I said, there's these snapshot memories that are singed in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I've ever shared my story with anyone, and I've never really told them the full on details, but the stories, that part of the story never changes. I will always remember his smell. I will always remember when he hurt me. I will, but then the outside is fuzzy.
What's fuzzy?
So like the time, for example, I had to sort of work my way backwards. I knew that my roommate would wake up between 6:30 and 7 to get ready for work. And so therefore, I knew that I could safely say that, you know, when the cat made a noise and I said, "Hey, you know, it's my roommate waking up, you might want to leave. I don't want you to get caught," because I pretended to be his friend by then. And he did. He used it as an opportunity to leave. So, and I knew that it was 3 hours, because I remember telling the police officers when they arrived, he was in my room for 3 hours. So I and it was still dark when he left. So 6 o'clock leaving, 3 o'clock arrival is a good proximity. The time of year is also questionable, except that I remember my detective that was assigned to my case gave me a Halloween card. And so I knew that it had to have happened the last 2 weeks of October. And then, you know, of course, I remember the neighborhood clearly. The house, I had to reconnect with my old roommate to have her help describe it to me.
You don't remember the house?
I do remember enough about the house, yes. But was my memory accurate? And based upon her memory of it, it was absolutely the same.
And when you talk about the house, you mean the doors, the opening?
The floor plan. The floor plan. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And so what I'm after here, Senda, and I'll think of new ways to ask you this question, because I want to really give to our listening audience the real deal about, because you suffered this trauma, and you're saying, yeah, there's things I can't remember, and what that is like, not being able to remember certain aspects of something that was so horrific for you.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that?
Well, so I knew the other thing that I can't quite remember or can't quite place is the sequence of events and how they happened, what order they took place. So I have these snapshot memories, and then I have to fill out the surrounding area to create, you know, so it makes sense. And then I had to say, all right, well, this had to happen first, and then this had to have happened, and then this had to have happened.
Give us an example of what had to happen.
Well, when I was sitting in front of him naked, was that towards the end of the 3 hours, or was that right away? And I remember him lunging at me 3 different times. So I remember when he was trying to remove this. I had a long sweatshirt robe that had a partial zipper up with a hoodie on the back, and that's what I'd worn to bed that night. And when he was trying to remove that and take it off of me, he used it as a weapon to strangle me. Now, of course, I remember that very well. And that made sense to me that had to have been the last, you know, that one of the closer times to the end of the night. You know, where then I'm sitting, he gets it off and I'm sitting naked in front of him.
In your book, I Know Now, you talk about being strangled.
Yeah.
And did you think you were going to die?
I started to lose consciousness. I was going in and out. I couldn't breathe. Things were getting really fuzzy. I've never been unconscious, so I'm assuming that's what was happening to me. And it was frightful. And there was one point where I was actually ready to just give up and just, you know, sink into whatever this feeling was. But when my body relaxed, I think he thought that I'd passed out. And then he shifted his weight on me, and that's when I was able to come out of it, and just enough to take a breath of air.
What do you mean when you say that you were ready to give up? You thought you were ready to give up. What was that like? And then how did you? I really want the listening audience and myself to understand. Yeah. How did you come back around? What woke you up? What gave you the strength to keep moving?
So I felt his, you know, he's strangling. I can't breathe. There's pressure around my throat. What he had done is he had taken my bathrobe and he had pulled it over my head. So my arms are still in my robe, but the portion of the body of the robe is over my face. And then he's tightening the neck around me, and tightening and twisting it and tightening it. But he's sitting on my back. And pinning me.
So you're face down?
I'm face down. And so he's pushing my head into my mattress or my pillow, and he's strangling and tightening the bathrobe, and he has me pinned. And I start to just, you know, and then he shifts, and I'm able to take in a deep breath, and in that moment, just turn. I mean, I just thought, I need to turn over because I needed to breathe. And the only way I could do that was to get my face out of whatever he was pushing me into, my pillow or my mattress, and turn. And then when I did that, I threw him off balance completely because I think he thought I was passed out. And I was able to gasp, and I sat up and I pulled the bathrobe completely off of me, and I threw it at him, and I got angry. By then, we'd been communicating, you know, for 2.5 hours, and I called him Bob. I gave him a name, and... it wasn't his name. It was a name I made up.
How do you know that wasn't his name?
I don't know. I asked him, trying to distract him, what is your name? And he goes, I'm not going to tell you. You know, you're crazy. And I'm like, well, if you're not going to tell me, then I'm going to call you Bob. Is that all right? Can I call you Bob?
At what point did you ask if you can remember about his name? When did you even, I'm just trying to understand, and I'm asking for myself and for our audience, how did you think about having a conversation with someone that's attacking you?
I know. Now, this is interesting. Can I talk about what happened to me when I was 14 years old?
Yeah. You know what, though?
Yeah.
We have a few seconds before we go to break. So let's start on that.
Right now?
Yes.
Okay. So when I was 14 years old, I read a magazine article from Cosmopolitan, and it was 1976, and it was called How to Say No to a Rapist and Survive. And I read that from the beginning to the end of that article, and I memorized everything in it. 5 years later, I put into play what I had read. And yet, it wasn't as if that article came to me. I never once thought of that article. For some reason, it was like embedded into my psyche, into my memory bank, is the only thing that I can think of. And what that article said was distract. You know, become his friend. Carry on a conversation as if he's a peer or an equal, and just, you know, distract him from what he's there for, and to calm him down, because he's probably just as afraid as you are. He doesn't know what you're going to do. So calm him down. Use your voice to calm down. The second I knew that when I yelled, he got violent, I knew I couldn't make him, I didn't want him to ever attack me like that again, but he still did, but not to that level like he did the first lunge.
Cinda, my heart is racing listening to you speak. We need to go to break. Stay with us. More with Cinda Stevens-Lonsway. I know now. Stay with us. We'll be right back. That was Daughters, a rendition by local talent Audrey Lewis. You are listening to Bread and Roses on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Della Ray, and we are in the studio with author Cinda Stevens-Lonsway. The book is I Know Now. And when we left for break, you were talking about the article that you read in Cosmopolitan when you were 14, not knowing that you were going to need that article years later. Tell us more.
Well, it was just crazy. So number one, I'm 14 years old and I'm not supposed to be reading magazines like that.
Right.
So I snuck it into, I was on vacation with my dad and his girlfriend at the time, and I snuck it under my covers and read that, found that article, found it fascinating, read it. Without knowing it, I memorized the entire thing, and then 5 years later actually put it into practice.
So it was distraction?
Distraction. It was to calm him down, to remember and to always think two steps ahead of the perpetrator, because you don't, I mean, he already knows his escape plan, probably. And in fact, he told me what his escape plan was.
What was it?
He said, I came in through the bathroom window and I'm going to leave through the back door. And, you know, and so he was telling me he was very proud of the plan. I think he liked to mess with my mind a little bit, you know, like, this is premeditated. I want you to be afraid. I've been watching you. I've been in your house. I've seen the dirty clothes in the basement. I've, you know, and yeah.
So. There's a point in the book where you talk about Cinda in this book. I mean, this book, the cover alone of this book, don't get me started on this book. It's amazing. It's a great read. Thank you for writing it. And I want to talk more about that in a minute. But there's a point in the book where you and your roommate, and you have this awesome relationship with your roommate.
I love her.
Yeah, who was just like, she took messages from your mom. She was like making sure your laundry was done, and she would do your make your lunch. I mean, it was just, you have a way of writing that draws your reader in. But there's a point in this book where you're talking about you notice someone watching you from outside.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was him?
Yes, absolutely. Well, he said that he had been watching us. And then before the attack, I was looking outside the window and I saw a reflection. I mean, I thought it was me, my reflection in the window. Well, see, we didn't have any blinds up.
Right.
So you know, anyone could pretty much see him. Now, it wasn't easy to see him because the house was set up off the road. It was like a story off the road. The hill was steep and... So, you know, you kind of had to really look hard or look up in order to look through the window. But at one point, I felt like someone was looking in at me and I screamed. And then I was talking on the phone to my boyfriend, who's now my husband. And he's like, what's going on? What's going on? And my roommate came running out, looked out the window, couldn't see anyone. So we talked ourselves into believing that it was nothing. But I knew in my gut that it was.
You know with your knower, right?
Yeah, I know with my knower.
Yeah, so you... He was because there's two of you, so he targeted you.
Right. There's a moment in when he comes into the room and he's standing at the foot of my bed, and I think, you know, because I'm groggy and I don't understand and I'm confused why there would be a person in my bedroom, unless, of course, he's the fix-it man that the landlord had sent to fix a hole in the wall, because we had a hole in the wall.
And you were thinking this at 3 a.m.?
Well, I didn't know it was 3 yet. So okay. I'm like, oh, are you the landlord? You know, and then I looked at the clock and I'm like, maybe you can come back later. And he's like, quiet, quiet, quiet. And I'm like, no, I mean, it's not okay that you're here this early. I mean, it was just, I was like, what is going on? But he then said, oh, you're not who I thought you were. And then and then he kicked the cat, shut the door, put the cat outside the door, shut the door. And I realized this isn't a very nice fix-it man. And now I'm alone with this guy and he's not very nice. And then I, you know, I can't remember what I wrote in the book, if I screamed first or I lunged first. But I'm curious if he came in and checked in on me first and woke me up and then had to deal with me, or if he was, I talk in the book that I'm very grateful he came into my room.
Okay. So,
and not hers.
I want to go back to the article.
Yes.
That we were just talking about that you read when you were 14 years old. In the article, one of the things that you just said was to, think two steps ahead.
Yes.
What did that mean for you in that moment at 3 a.m. where you are being attacked? How did you think steps ahead of this person?
Right. So at one point I'm sitting up and I'm talking to him. And so I'm doing the distraction portion and I'm asking him about, where are you? Where are you from? Do you live around here? What's your name? He would throw the questions back at me. What's your name? You know, where do you work?
Did you tell him?
Well, what's really interesting about that is I had the wherewithal to think of two different answers. And one was, I don't want to tell him the truth if he doesn't know. And yet he says he's been watching us. So what does he already know? And I don't want to make him angry by telling him a lie.
So, Cinda, I got to slow us down. I got to just talk a little bit more. But it had to be more than that article that you read. It had to be.
That's
what I'm thinking.
It had to be.
I mean, to be able to be on your feet, you know, to be able to get through a situation. I don't even want to use the word situation. Such a challenging moment in your life where your life is threatened, and it and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do want to ask you about, you're doing this in between being attacked, strangled, and in this book, you know, your sweatshirt being pulled up over your head and being strangled.
Yeah.
And how did you do it?
So the part three of the book, you know, the book is divided into three sections, but part three is the book is me going back and analyzing that exact question. And I realize, as now a spiritual practitioner, is how I had to have been tapping into my intuition, if not even some larger or bigger guidance had to have been at play. It had to have been. Now, I don't remember there being a voice outside of my head guiding me, but then sort of a fun kind of crazy thought is when I was writing part three, which was about my process of writing, I'm actually traveling back in time.
Yes.
And I'm actually in the bedroom with 19-year-old Cinda, and a thought occurred to me, wouldn't it just be crazy if we could actually time travel like that, and I could have been there, and I could have been the one. And actually also in part two, of my story, 30-year-old Cinda goes back and relives it in the bedroom with 19-year-old Cinda.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it just be an amazing thought to think that future self could be there with, you know, 19-year-old us saying, here he comes, this is what you got to do, trick him, don't worry, you're going to be okay, go ahead, do this next move, you're going to be okay.
But you didn't know you were going to be okay.
No.
You didn't know that.
And, no, and but I had to trust it. There was a trust. There was a trust at one
trust
point.
In what?
There was a trust that I said, either this is going to work or I'm toast. Either what I am about ready to do is going to work or I'm dead. I mean, it's the last straw. And I did it anyway. And I kind of don't want to give it away because I want people to read about it. But I just, there was something in me that just said, do it anyway. Do it anyway.
What do you have to lose?
What do you have to lose? You almost died.
But you're 19. And you know, you think about your thinking ability at 19.
I know.
And so there's a point where, I'm not sure if this part was specifically in the book, but while we were getting ready for the interview, you were talking about how you went back and you were writing this book and how you literally replayed putting on the sweatshirt and pulling it up over your head.
Tell us
about that.
Yeah, so in order to help me remember, I had an amazing editor right there at the beginning, and she would call me out on it. Not deep enough. There aren't enough details. Go deeper. So I would, you know, get angry and frustrated. Then I would go and I would rewrite.
Why were you angry and frustrated?
Well, because I thought I was deep enough, and there was a level of protection inside of me that I didn't want to go any deeper, and I was deep enough. And she'd say, but the story isn't full. You know, it's choppy. You need to tell more. There needs to be more meat. And so one of those was, when I was being strangled by my bathrobe, did he throw it over the top of me, or, you know, like bring it from the back, over the back of my head, or did he bring it over the front? And in order to remember that, I had to practice with the sweatshirt with the zipper zipped all the way up to my neck.
Literally.
I had, but here's the thing. I can't forever now. I panic if I'm pulling something off over my head and it gets stuck in my earring and it's over my face, right? And or it's too tight around my neck and doesn't come off easier. I go into hyperventilation and almost a panic. And so I'm very cautious when I pull things over my face now, right? So this is what I had to do, Della. I locked my bedroom door. I walked.
When was this?
This was in the writing of the book.
Okay.
Years
later?
33 years later when I started writing it. 33 years later, and I'm trying to remember the best to my ability how everything played out. And so, but I knew that this was going to freak me out, and I didn't trust my reaction. And I didn't want anyone to hear me, see me, come in on me. So I locked my bedroom door. I went into my bathroom. I locked my bathroom door. I went into my walk-in closet. I closed my door. I put on my sweatshirt, and I took a deep breath, and I tried to pull it up over the front of me, and I didn't panic. I mean, I sort of did, but I just tried not to. And then I thought, no, he pulled it over the back of me and around the top of me, and then that's how he was able to pull it tight around my neck to strangle me with it.
How long did it take you during that exercise to realize what happened so many years ago?
In that moment, it was frightening, and I just seconds. I mean, I didn't let it take very much of my time. I just did it, and I thought, oh my God, it didn't kill me. I was able to do it.
So, Cinda, there's so much here, but what I want to get to is, in this book, you had a detective
yes.
who believed you, who
yes.
followed you, who
yes.
was there for you, who was supporting you.
Yes.
What would that be like if, what would your story be like if he didn't believe you?
You know, from the very beginning when I called the police and the police came, you know, he was like my superhero in blue, and I immediately felt safe. And he treated both my roommate and me with utmost respect. The detective, when I met him the next day, this amazing, I mean, I will love him till the day I die.
Right.
The gratitude I have for him. He didn't end up catching him.
Right.
But he worked his tail off doing whatever he could.
What if he wouldn't have believed you? And of course, I'm looking at what's
yes,
happening on the main
point.
Stage with Dr. Ford and Kavanaugh, no one believing her.
Yeah. And no one believed. Right.
What would that? How do you think that would have changed your story? Your experience. It's not a story. Your experience. How would that have changed it?
So that's really interesting because I haven't really thought about that. When I very first met him, he arrived with another detective, and they put a panic button in my bedroom, and because they were convinced he was going to come back. And they taught us how to use it, and we experimented and tested it out. And he said, the second you push this button, everyone would come running. So that panic button actually became something to fear, because it reminded us of what happened, because we were trying to pretend it never did. And
who was trying to pretend it never did?
My roommate and I. I was. Well, see, okay, here's the deal, and this is going to relate. I wasn't bruised, battered, raped, maimed or murdered. I had no marks. I had no proof. And it was my word against whoever. So when that police officer first came and he saw me, there had to have been some moment where he knew that I was telling the truth. And I mean, I put my bathrobe back on, but I put it on backwards, so the hood was in the front, and I wasn't even aware that I had done that. And then, you know, he had something made him believe me. And then I met the detective, and all he had was my story. But I had no markings, I had no proof, just my shaky voice. That was it. And I don't know why they believed me. I'm just so grateful that they did. And let me just make this perfectly clear.
Please do.
It is imperative. And I mean, not just because of what's happened to Dr. Ford. It is imperative. Okay, I see what you're asking me now. I just had to let it settle in. When I told my parents, I took the, right after it happened, I drove down and I told my dad, and then I drove to my mom's house and I told my mom, and I was scared to death they wouldn't believe me. And yet at the same time, I barely even covered the surface of what happened to me, because I felt like I needed to protect them. So what I shared with them was minimal to what actually happened, but I felt like it was an obligation to let them know. So go on.
No, you're good.
Okay, so the police knew by then, and they were out searching and searching and searching. My parents now knew. My roommate, of course, I told her immediately after Bob left, and then...
Did you tell your roommate all the details?
She knew a lot. She knew a lot. There was a few times she sat in with the detective interviewing me.
Why were you sparing other people this pain? Why did you think that was a good idea?
Okay, so I think it's multi-layered, and I think it's a really important question. But I think that number one, I was scared enough for everybody. And if I told them what really happened and they became scared, then, which of course any loving parent would, right? Then I would have to take care of their fear as well as mine. And I could barely contain myself in that moment.
So I want to dig a little deeper.
Yes, please.
You
do.
Said, I was scared enough for everyone.
For everyone.
Do you hear yourself?
Yeah.
I was How scared can you be scared enough for everyone? How's that possible?
I don't know. I don't know. I knew that if I told my dad everything, and if I told my mom everything, and if I told my boyfriend everything, and they became frightened, then I would have to take care of their frightenedness, their fear.
Sure, but you are carrying the weight.
Yeah, absolutely.
For everyone.
Absolutely.
And so think about, you know, women today, how many women are carrying the weight of what their experience has been.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you say to that?
Well, I can tell you this, that then when the story came out, I asked my mom, do you remember me telling you? I asked my boyfriend, who's now my husband, do you remember me telling you? And they said, well, your voice was very shaky. And my husband said, I think that you downplayed what really happened. And I, you know, I did. I did. I wanted them to know the fact that this is what happened to me, but FYI, I'm okay, and everything's great, and I'm safe, and nothing happened to me, and I'm going to go back to the house and meet my detective, and we're going to catch this guy, and I'm going to keep going to work, and I'm going to pretend that none of this happened, because I wasn't actually bruised, maimed, murdered, raped, you know.
And that was your excuse.
That was my excuse. And then I would like to say there is a piece of shame.
We need to go to break. Stay with us. More with I Know Now with Cinda Stevens Lonsway. We'll be right back.
Hey, June, your letter into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey, don't be afraid, you were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her into your skin, then you begin to make it better. And anytime you feel the pain, to refrain, don't carry the world up on your shoulder.
Thank you for staying with us. That was Hey Jude, another rendition by local talent Audrey Lewis. You are listening to your community radio station, KBOO 90.7. We are Bread and Roses, and I'm your host, Ella Ray, and we are in the studio with Cinda Stevens Lonsway. The book is Now I Know. When we left for break, Cinda, you just said something that was so powerful, mm-hmm. and I want to go here, and I want to spend some time on it. You said you felt shame. You were attacked. You were carrying the burden for your family, your friends, your boyfriend, your mom, your dad. You had just been through something unthinkable.
Yeah.
Unthinkable, excuse me, and horrendous. Yet you felt shame. Tell us about that.
So how do you tell your mom and your dad that you were naked in bed with a complete stranger that was trying to kill you? And how do you tell them that and not have them think that maybe there was something I did to encourage that? And how could I have allowed it to get that far that I am sitting naked with him in my bed? Of course, I mean, you know, I just had, there's all sorts of versions of what could happen or what someone could say. And I did not want, to tell them that those details. I didn't want them to question why it happened or what I had done or possibly had done in order to have encouraged his behavior.
And isn't that and I don't want to use the word interesting, but I'm going to use it because that's the first thing that comes up, is that that would ever cross your mind? What is it in society? What is it in people that women, people, who's ever being attacked, would it would ever cross your mind what you possibly could have done or had a role in this happening to you?
Right, right, right.
What is that, do you think? So
I think that we as a culture, we have a tendency to shame the victim, and we have a tendency to blame the victim. And in that, this culture, I was raised in this culture, right? So I just was fearful that I was going to get blamed. And I was questioning myself and my roommate, and how is it that we were the ones he chose to pick on? You know, what did we do wrong? And even though I kind of wasn't thinking those questions entirely, there is this trained behavior that I had that wanted me to protect myself from those closest to me by not giving out the complete facts. Now, I believe that with my detective, I did. I think I told him everything.
Tell us more about this trained behavior. What is that? What do you mean when you say trained behavior?
Well, you know, so you're aware of how victims, especially of sexual assault, are treated. We see it all the time. We see it on the news. We see it in the media. I grew up with it. I grew up exposed to it. It's something that we don't even think about until we experience it, and then we protect ourselves from it.
And look what happened. Here we are. 2018.
Yeah, it hasn't changed.
And look
much.
What happened to Dr. Ford. What would you say to her if you had the opportunity?
She is a hero, a shero.
Why? In your words, why?
So, because I believe her. I believe her because her voice shaked and she spoke up anyway. I believe her because she doesn't remember the outside fuzziness of the incident, but can tell in detail the moment when she felt her life was threatened. I know exactly what that was like. Her story is my story. And I saw myself in her. My mom even called me in tears and was like, "Cinda, are you watching this? This is you, isn't it? This is you." And I'm like, "Mom, this is devastating."
But and you this want, is during listening to her testimony.
They're during her, right in the middle of her testimony. And I will tell you this, that if that was me and Brett Kavanaugh was my perpetrator, I would absolutely, if that was Bob, I would have come forward. Absolutely. And same amount of years later, she came forward with her story when I came forward with mine.
You mean in the time span?
In the time span.
What made you come forward to tell this story, to write this book? What made you do it?
So I had experienced, can I talk about the part two, the post-traumatic stress?
Yes.
So,
and part two in the book.
Part two in the book. So the first part of the book is about the attack and the months that followed when he stalked my roommate and me and the relationship that I had with my amazing detective. And then in part two, so they never caught the guy. My roommate and I end up leaving the neighborhood. We go our separate ways, and I pretend it never happened. And then in my early 30s, I go through post-traumatic stress. I know now is why the name of the book is that was what was happening to me.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to your community radio station, 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Ella Ray, and we are in the studio with Cinda Stevens-Lonsway. And you're there, and you're deciding.
Yeah, so I just ignored, pretended, went about my life as I felt like any normal 20-year-old would, all through my 20s, pretending that nothing ever awful had ever happened to me. And then I have my first child, and this feeling of vulnerability that I had never experienced before showed itself to me, because it's one thing for me at 19 to protect just myself. It's another thing for me to now protect my child. And of course, I'm married and my husband could have helped, but I had this psychosis thing going on of post-traumatic stress. It made no sense. For 5 years, and then in that middle, I had a second child, and then everything was getting triggered.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
So you the person you were dating when you were attacked is the man that you married
yes.
and had babies with.
Yes, yes.
Did he ever get the full story before you wrote the book?
No. And he hasn't read it yet. He's afraid to read it.
Okay.
Poor guy.
Okay. Whoa. So you have your second child.
Yes.
Your husband does not know the full extent of your story.
No.
What were you like? How were you?
Okay. So this is really important because I was experiencing rage.
How did that show up?
Just my post-traumatic stress or my stress or my anxiety showed itself with rage. I was just so unhappy and unkind. I felt inside there was this darkness that I could not control. And I became a very controlling mother and I controlled my environment. OCD, everything was clean. I was volunteering in the schools and being, you know, psycho volunteer. It was my job. I mean,
Did you say psycho volunteer?
Yes.
Okay.
I just dove in and tried to control everything outside of me because I couldn't control the emotions that were building up. Because I couldn't control the emotions that were building up inside of me, and it presented itself as rage. And I was very afraid that I was going to hurt my children and devastate my family. I never got to that point, but boy, it sure could have.
How did the rage show up?
A lot of yelling, a lot of growling. At who? My children, my husband, neighbors.
Did your husband say anything? Did he notice? Did anyone know? You know, your mom? Did you talk to your mom?
I remember I talked to my mom, and I even talked to my stepmom. I said, Mom, did you ever? And she said, no.
Did you ever? What?
Did you ever experience that you were reaching a point of no return, that you were losing yourself, that life was too stressful? And she had a tough life growing up. And I mean, growing up. And she said, no, I just made do. And then a little while later, a box arrived in the mail, and it was filled with books. And one book was, If Mama Ain't Happy, No One's Happy. And there was a letter on top that said, oh my God, I forgot. I remember now. And it was beautiful, and that was helpful. My stepmom, I remember talking to her.
Who sent you the books?
My mom.
Your mom sent you the books after basically telling you to.
Yeah, she said, I just, you know, chin up.
So let me ask you this. Did your mom know your whole story?
No, she never. No,
so
she didn't.
Okay.
No, and I didn't even know that it was what happened to me at 19 years old that was triggering what was happening now. I just thought I was a lousy mom. I thought that being a mom was so freaking difficult that I was just so angry and unhappy. I mean, I loved my kids. I loved my life. I loved my husband. I had no reason to be experiencing the rage that I was experiencing.
So you thought you had no reason, right?
I thought I had no reason because I did not tie it back I did not tie back the stress and anxiety to my attack.
And so
but yet at the same time, I had triggers that brought the memories back.
Right. But I want to stop here because think about, especially since what's happening on the big stage with Dr. Ford, how many women are saddled down with this horrible emotion and the words that you use that they're going through right now and because this is not something, you know, like you said, we are socialized to blame the victim and shame. And so think about women who are dealing with this and not sure what they're, and not aware. What do you say to that?
Well, this is some clarity that I got from actually writing the book. When in part three, I look back about the signs. I look back to try to see from this observing perspective as I kind of time travel and look for warnings and signs and guidances that might have been there. And one of the things that I realized is the pain and suffering that I was experiencing in my early 30s as a mother of young children was that suffering was not meant to be run away from. I wasn't supposed to run away from it. I wasn't supposed to deny it. That suffering, that pain, it wasn't designed for more pain.
Say that again.
Okay. The suffering that I was experiencing wasn't designed for pain. It was actually designed for guidance. Mm-hmm. Guidance to direct me to where I could find my healing.
When did you get to the point where you started to heal and make the correlation and move forward?
So after about 5 years, and it probably might have even been longer, of pure torture to myself, emotional torture, emotional head games. I call it the perfect storm of events that piled up on top of each other. More stress, more stress, more stress, losing my mind, losing my mind, losing my mind. I had an incident one night where I was convinced the perpetrator had found me. And I stayed up all night waiting for him to show himself, trying to protect my family from this guy. I mean, the psychosis of that moment is crazy making, but he was in my house. I knew he was there. I searched every place. And if he wasn't in my house, he was outside waiting to come in. And I sat there waiting and waiting and waiting. And the physical pain I was experiencing in that moment was so awful. And then at one point I thought, I can't live like this. 1 second longer. I can't do this. I am dying here. I am killing myself. I don't know what this is, but I give up. And I went upstairs, I crawled into bed next to my beautiful husband, and I just silently cried my eyes out. And I put this, I said, I give up. Take me. Just take me. This has got to end now. It's got to end. I can't do this one more second. And in that moment, I heard these words, clear as day. And it said, Cinda, love your enemy, and there you will find your peace. And, you know, it was God. I thought the devil was going to show up and take me away, my demons. And instead of the devil, God came. But God presented himself in the body of my perpetrator. Because what happened next is I was guided through this profound ritual of healing where I actually called the higher spirit of the perpetrator into the room with me. And I swear to God, he was there. I could see him. I talked to him. And I was guided through a profound ritual of healing where I sent him love. And in that moment, everything changed. When he accepted the love, I fell asleep and woke up the next morning to a brand new day. I was completely, and what I thought, 100% healed. I was never the same.
But that was years figuring things out. Did you get help?
Never got help. It never occurred to me, Della, it never occurred to me that maybe if I could find, that I should maybe see a therapist. Never occurred to me.
The book, you titled it, I Know Now. What do you know now?
So I actually cover that in the last few chapters. But when I was at a book signing recently, a woman asked me, so the biggest question I have to ask you is, what do you know now? And the most profound answer came out of me. And that is that throughout the years prior to me writing my story, I would share my story. But I would share it from a very safe place. I would share just the scary stuff, just enough to kind of scare the listener. But there'd be a place inside of my gut that the story would hit. And when I hit that barrier, I knew I had to stop. I wouldn't go any deeper in the details. And then I would quickly get to the point where the victim outsmarts the villain and wins the day. And so what I know now is because of this process of writing my story, of telling my truth, and having the people I love actually read it and know my truth for the first time, is I can travel all the way down through where that barrier used to be, because it's not there anymore, all the way down to my big toe, all the way back up. I am free. Mm. Absolutely free.
Cinda, what a great, great sharing of your experience. But that does it for our show. We need to wrap it up. We are Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs, and we bring you this show every Friday night at 6 p.m., and we've been on the air for 39 years, and you can find us at kboo.fm/breadandroses. Thank you, Cinda Lonsway-Stevens, for being a guest on our show, and thank you to our engineer, Teresa, for taking such great care of us. And what I say is, dear listener, self-care is essential to everything 100% of the time. There's no exceptions. And until next time, if nothing else, and above all else, choose you.
The time is now 7 p.m. Next up is Hard Knock Radio. Thank you very much.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Mother, Daughter, Sister on Saturday, October 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Mother, Daughter, Sister exposes the Burmese military's practice of using rape as a weapon of war. Testimonies from survivors, witnesses, and activists explore the far-reaching impact of sexual violence upon women and communities as they call for justice and a unified stand for an end to impunity. A panel discussion will follow the film and includes the filmmaker and local community leaders and activists. Again, that's Mother, Daughter, Sister on Saturday, October 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Cinema 21. 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Food for the Soul on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Tiffany Center in Portland.